look and see what you think the need is. Don't wait for that permission. If you think like, oh, their you know, logo needs a refresh, go try to refresh it yourself and update it, and then send them like 7 different logo designs. Even if they're just like, oh, all these are amateurish and how, like, I don't want to change my logo. It doesn't matter. All of a sudden you just demonstrated, you know, a resource for them.
Welcome to Lessons in Leverage, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of success. We'll help you unlock the secrets of leverage so you can amplify your impact in the world. Here's your host, Spencer Lowe.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons in Leverage. I'm excited today to be joined by Agent Crew. He is the CEO of The Wine Spies, a wine e-tailer and e-commerce technology company. And since 2007, his company has featured a brand new wine on their site every single day at the best price on planet Earth for a 24-hour window. So really excited to get a little bit into your story, Agent Crew, and go all the way back to kind of some of your upbringing, how we got here. But before I do that, thanks for being on the show. How's it going for you? You having a good day?
Yeah, what's up, man? Thanks for having me on. It's great. Business is booming, man. So we actually had our biggest day in company history yesterday. It's all about
that. Yeah, love to hear that.
Feeling pretty hyped on that. 16 years in the business doing that. So, you know, it's nice to still be hitting those milestones.
All right. Well, before we get into your story, tell me about these code names and you know, you're fitting a really unique Take Boots brand. So tell me just a quick pitch about Wine Spies and what's up with the code names.
For sure, man. Yeah. So Wine Spies is, like you said, we sell one different wine every 24 hours. So that's super fun because you're always trying something new. And basically, it's like a deal a day flash site model. It's actually now the largest running company like that. But our secret sauce is that you can throw those wines into what we call a locker. And so you can kind of aggregate different purchases together over actually as long as you want. We'll hold it as long as you want and then ship a case for free when it's full. But yeah, so Wine Spies, it all started out with we're going on missions to find crazy deals on wines. And the funny thing is, you know, now we're like a proper company with a ton of employees and we all actually go by our code name. So, you know, now in the wine industry, people know us and just accept it as normal. But for the longest time, people were just like, what do you mean, Agent Crew? What the hell are you talking about? Like, live the brand, baby.
How'd you get your code name?
Well, yeah, so my real name is Addison Rex, so it's not that secret. But when I came over from my family winery, my now business partner, Agent Red, spent years trying to recruit me. When I finally joined up, I'm like, all right, man, this is my only chance I'm ever going to have to be Agent Rex. So I'm not about to join the FBI anytime soon. So you got to let me be Agent Rex. And he's like, it's not a code name if it's your real name, man. So I had to pick real fast. Crew is basically like, you know, in France, it's Premier Crew, Grand Crew. It basically means the best of the best, you know?
There you go. Well, that's a great way to get to it. And it aligns to kind of the vision of the company. I love that just from a cultural standpoint, kind of having some unique things that you guys can adopt and run with. So well, let's go back a little bit. You know, I know that you came up in a family business. So you've been in wine and wineries, sounds like a long time going back deep. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what was it like starting out in that family business? And what was your progression like leading up to kind of deciding to branch out?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the family business thing, it's a truly wonderful opportunity to be able to work with something that you have just a natural passion for, you know, regardless of what you do. Obviously, it's way more fun when it's wine rather than selling, you know, the family carpet cleaning business. But if my dad is actually an architect, my mom's a writer, and it's my dad's brother, my uncle, who's the winemaker. And it was in high school where my college and career counselor, who happened to be excellent, was, you know, trying to figure out what I should do, what I should apply to. And she was kind of asking about, well, do you have any family members doing something interesting? And I'm like, well, I was a winemaker. And she's like, yeah, you can actually study that now. You know, so if you're 18 years old, given the choice to go to the alcohol industry, you're like, I choose that one. So that was kind of an easy thing to have the decision made for me at an early age. But then, you know, once I started working in earnest, you know, it really is a double-edged sword because the constant fear of being perceived as being there for nepotism reasons, it actually really makes you, you know, constantly try to want to prove yourself. And for me personally, I mean, I far from taking it for granted, it gave me a lot of extra motivation to, you know, be the best person in the organization to prove that I deserve to be there. And, you know, kind of starting out from the production side and just being a cellar rat and doing all the dirty jobs, and then finally kind of taking on more responsibility along the admin and operations side. You know, really, it really just kind of, it took me teaching myself what are the things that this is missing that we don't currently have that I could add the most value. And then that's the way that I leveled up, because it wasn't so much, hey, let me show you the ropes, nephew. It was more like, oh, okay, clearly this winery, this business needs XYZ thing. And as I learned to fill those niches and just became, you know, a more valuable person, you kind of naturally rise in any organization. And so by the time I left, I had become the general manager. And, you know, it's a 30,000 case winery in Sonoma Valley called Deerfield Ranch Winery. It's a beautiful place. And, you know, it was definitely a big jump going from that, a prestige winery, and running that to essentially joining a small tech startup. Even though it had been around at that point for 10 years, I joined WineSpy 7 years ago, it was still being run out of a small office suite. And we have a 23,000 square foot cave in beautiful wine country. So it was a scary move. But I mean, now, you know, we've 10x'd the company since I came on. I'm the CEO now. And, you know, it really took a whole team to make that happen here. But, you know, I've grown so much in that process. And now me and my business partner have several other companies. And it's really just, we bought this awesome 17,000 square foot warehouse we're sitting in now. That's our HQ. And, you know, none of that would have been possible had I not kind of taken that leap. So you gotta throw caution to the wind sometime.
Is that what it felt like for you at the time? Was it sort of throwing caution to the wind? Did it feel like you were kind of giving up a safe choice for a risk? What was the calculus like? What did your mindset have to be to be willing or able to walk away from kind of the family business and to take on something that maybe did at least seem on the surface riskier or a little less certain?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely the riskier move. I mean, even just from a public perception standpoint, I mean, the wine industry is, everyone knows each other. It's a super small pond. And certainly I'd built up a lot of relationships in the Sonoma Valley. And so, you know, and also just moving to what is effectively an e-commerce discount site, you know, that there's definitely the whole prestige. There's a little bit different in terms of how everyone's looking at it then, now very different, but I just had recognized that not only was I not going to be able to grow, but I wasn't going to be able to reach my objectives. And I think the thing at the end of the day that made the decision for me more than anything is, am I going to be able to continue to be impactful, you know? And if you care about not just kind of growing your personal resume or day-to-day quality of life, but accomplishment and building things, if you want to build things, you know, that was the main deciding factor. I just recognized that I wasn't going to be able to build new things. And there's a little bit more to the story that, you know, is family drama, you know. But at the end of the day, that really was the most important part. And my partner, Agent Red, you know, he's like a dyed-in-the-wool entrepreneur, had started like 8 different companies before he found success with WineSpies. And now we're moving to kind of a business incubator model here in the business with kind of shared marketing services and shared back-end office admin services and kind of a bunch of different revenue centers, which has been really kind of interesting, taking like one successful business, the goose that's laying the golden egg, and then trying to, you know, morph that into something that is able to support different, completely different businesses with maybe different teams. So
yeah,
it worked out.
Yeah. Needless to say, it seems like it works out pretty well. Yeah. So what is the mindset shift going from a very legacy business, like a winery, I imagine, to one of those more laggard industries, something that's more traditional, more conventional, conservative? And then what shifts for you as you move into a technology business, and what did you have to do with your mindset to kind of be able to succeed in that new environment?
Yeah, and I mean, you're spot on. I mean, the wine industry is famous for being slow to adopt, you know, new practices. I mean, it is continuously almost a full decade behind, but tangibly at least 5 years behind best business practices, taking care of technology. And what's funny is that, you know, there is a army of people out there that do all kinds of service and support companies that would love to work with the wine industry. You know, they go to wine industry, go to wine country, they see it's super fun. They go to these chateaus, they're like, oh shit, well, these guys obviously have got some money. You know, if I could build a point of sale product or a robot or some AI tool, you know, why not offer it to the wine industry, especially because the need is obviously there because these guys are doing things like it's 1999. But they're always knocking at their door with good ideas, and yet the wineries are just unable to quickly embrace it. It is because wine has so much about it is steeped in tradition, and like this is how we do things. It is a cultural mindset. But what's more than that is it genuinely is a hard business, and there's a lot of entrenched market segments. Like distribution that works a certain way, and these legacy systems they self-protect. And then on top of that, it's very, very hard to make wine, and there's always something problem and fire to put out. And so, you know, kind of it's hard to get, you're always behind the eight ball such that, you know, you're not figuring out how to take advantage and implement tools effectively so that you're actually starting to leverage some of these kinds of solutions that would give you the time and space to continue to become a better company. So with the move to the e-commerce side and like how I had to change my mind, I actually didn't, because that's already what I wanted to do and where my heart is. But the cool part about the decision that Agent Red made very, very early on in the business was we're going to build the product ourselves. At the time, there really wasn't, you know, Shopify wasn't as flexible as it was. These out-of-the-box e-commerce solutions didn't quite exist at the level that they now do. But there were a few options. And what most people that were trying to kind of do wine e-com did was take an off-the-shelf product and then try to customize it and fit this, you know, they basically take this thing that really wasn't ever going to work, and you ended up with a platypus every single time. It never really did a good job. The front end experience did not match other, you know, e-com offerings in different categories. And so at great cost, you know, he built it himself. And there's a trade-off there where still to this day, you know, WineSpy's, the front end site, is powered by a completely turnkey back end, which has got CRM, inventory management, you know, the merchandising of our daily sales, because we sell one different wine every day. That's all automated with the calendar, all the email flows, all the marketing aspect of it, all the logistics, all the compliance. It does everything. And so now the trade-off is Shopify has, you know, hundreds of engineers working on the product. We have one engineer. Well, we've got a small team, but we've got like one CTO and a couple junior devs kind of thing. And so we kind of have to do everything ourselves. If it breaks, we have to fix it. But what it allows us to do is we don't have to rely on anybody else to be on their development calendar. When we want something done and we see the market opportunity, we prioritize it and we go build it. And consequently, you know, we've been able to deploy differentiating features, which are just obviously better, and our competitors just they don't have it. And then when they try to go build it, they're in the position of having to do the workarounds that we don't have to do, because we just dial in exactly what the customer experience should be. And yeah, and so that double-edged sword is a trade-off, and you kind of there's costs involved that we otherwise wouldn't have trying to maintain the software ourselves. But ultimately, it's been, I think, the thing that's made WineSpy's an actual technology company operating in the wine space, whereas everybody else is a wine company trying to make use of tech, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important distinction. What's one of the examples of one of those features that really made a big difference for you or delighted customers that you were able to get to faster?
Yeah, I mean, lockers is the big one. And we actually had, you know, when I came on board in 2017, I was like, what is your best idea that you just haven't implemented? And he's like, well, I have this thing. It's called cubbies, where, you know, you could take different purchases and put in your cubby and then ship it all at once. At the time, all of our competitors were, including us, were buy 6 bottles, get free shipping, and we offer 1 wine, like this wine. So you can think about it, like the value proposition is like, all right, this is a stupid good deal. It's $100 wine. We got it for, you know, 70% off, so it's $30. You're like, damn, that sounds great. I'd try that for $30. Oh, but I buy 6 of them, or that's $180. You know, am I going to drop $180 on a wine I've never tried before? Totally different proposition. So for us to come along and say, okay, no, you actually can just buy that one bottle for $30. And then tomorrow you can get a different one, and tomorrow you get a different one, and still get free shipping when you have a full locker. That was a game changer for sure. But then not just offering that core business model change, but also the front end experience. If you go to winespies.com and go check out, we put so much effort into being able to do that in one click, because with wine, it's like, it's heavy, it's fragile, it's perishable. And so it's temperature sensitive. So crucially, you know, you have to, are you good? Do you want to have temperature controlled shipping? Do you want to have ice packs? Do you want to hold this order for a couple weeks? And all these things that are specific to wine, you know, there's regulations and stuff and compliance things. So being able to do all of that with a customized checkout flow so that you can set instant checkout settings and then with one click, add to locker, place purchase, that experience didn't exist. So that's really kind of like the core of it. And right now we're adding a little sneak preview, giving you a scoop right now. We're going to be adding a monthly recurring revenue model here pretty soon. And that's going to be a big game changer for us too. And it's the same kind of thing where that does not exist off the shelf. We will be the only people to have this feature set because we built it ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a great mentality. I mean, in my main business, we are technology software consultants. And this is something a lot of people get wrong, which is, how do I decide when to build versus buy? And what we usually tell people is that starting point of the calculus for that is, can you create a meaningful competitive advantage with what you're building? Because if you can't, then you should adopt what's off the shelf, because now you're spending a bunch of extra money and time, and you're slower, like you said, in certain areas, and you fall behind the best practices because you have to pay to do it all yourself. And so companies that build that on their own just to have a similar product to what's available, it's terrible strategy. But if you can build your own in such a way that you have things that are not publicly available, or it's reinforcing competitive advantage and driving additional profit margin, I mean, that's a massive, such a strategic win. And so I think it's such a great, it's a high leverage way to use technology and understand, when should I be deploying something that's readily available? When should I be custom building? And the other thing is just, when can I mix those? That's another level to it of, you know, how do I mix the right elements of what should we custom build versus what should we get off the shelf? And so that can be a real hard battle. And it's cool to see how you guys have done that in such a successful way and created meaningful, not just competitive advantage, but a meaningful customer experience out of that really makes life easier for customers to shop with you.
Well, and actually, I mean, you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think that's such a good lens to look at it through. And a lot of times, if you do look at it through that lens, the answer will become obvious to you right away. Yeah, why am I trying to reinvent the wheel? This already exists. It's going to be exactly the same. And MailChimp is going to, you know, continue to optimize it for me. You know, let them figure out how to be a mass mailing campaign service, you know, rather than try to build one myself. You know, I think really one of the interesting things that we're now running into is answering this question for ourselves. You know, our biggest leverage point that we've had to date has been that we've automated the entire process as much as possible. What's crazy about WineSpies is, you know, we could absolutely run this company with a skeleton crew of 2 people, and we've done it. You know, and I'm talking like an eight-figure business, like legitimately could be done. When on weekends, everything is automated. The site runs itself completely. All the campaigns go out, everything switches over, new product goes up, everything like that. But it's every step of the process that we've automated so that we can focus on, you know, spending our time figuring out how to grow our business. But now, and the reason that's been possible is because we built that turnkey tech stack in-house. now it's gotten to the point where we're starting to have to make these decisions where it's like, oh, okay, well, you know, Klaviyo, MailChimp, you got such badass marketing automations. How much of the actual marketing touch points are we going to internalize over here? But you've got your CRM over here and you've got all your data over here. You know, now, okay, are we exporting this kind of stuff to Google Analytics and using that to pull, you know, so that we could get all of the different conversion steps, get that into our automation flows. At every single time we do that, you start to recognize it's like, oh, we're actually not developing our core product as much. We're doing that thing, which everyone does, where we've got all these different services and now are in the business of constantly trying to make everything play nice with each other. But as that actually gets consistently more easy, as all of the integrations get consistently more fluid cross platforms, it is, you know, that's all happened within the last, you know, 4 years to the level where it's like everything talks to each other, everything works well. All of these companies have a deep, you know, economic incentive to be excellent at integrations rather than trying to create walled gardens. And so we are now in that process of radically changing how we make these exact decisions, where it's like you have an instinct to know, let's go rebuild that whole marketing dashboard in what we call mainframe, our back end. Okay, maybe actually we need to fully rely and leverage just MailChimp, bet on it, put all of our data over there and start using it as our actual core CRM. And those are very, especially when it's in our company DNA to do it a certain way, you know, reevaluating those positions. It's been really interesting and challenging, and we're still kind of figuring that out, you know?
Yeah, one thing that I think is going to happen, something just to think about, I think that you're in an interesting spot where if you want to continue to custom building things in the short term, AI is enabling us to write code significantly faster and maintain code significantly more effectively. So proprietary solutions are actually becoming less expensive to manage over time. And so investing in the right AI tools to speed up development and sort of stay on top of those things is one element to consider. Another element to consider is that I actually think a lot of data integration is going to go away. I don't know the exact timeline, but because already as everything becomes, if all of your systems, both proprietary and off the shelf, are accessible to a single AI, then it is going to be able to, the need to integrate, most of the time we're integrating because we need to move data over to another system so that it can perform some value in that system.
Exactly.
So we're spending all this time moving data between systems in our integrations today. And I actually think data movement's going to entirely disappear because, well, I don't know if entirely, but mostly disappear, because if AI can stand between all those and read from each source system and say, okay, here's what needs to happen, it can just call the events. It can share what it needs to share. And so I think that there's going to be some big updates in sort of data architecture coming with some of the big breakthroughs in AI. And so, I don't know, something to maybe watch, but it is a very interesting set of trade-offs to always decide. And that's what we help companies do as well. We help with designing some of those integrations, et cetera. So we also run into that on a regular basis of like, should they build, should they buy, should they move this data, should it fully integrate, should we partially integrate, should it's just a lot of those are our decisions. So, but it's a good position to be in to have those options. And it seems like you guys have made really smart decisions to this point. So exciting to see. I want to go back real quick, a little bit away from the technology side, and go back to something you mentioned early on, which was, you know, in a business like wine, you know, I built up all these relationships. Talk to me about what was the role of relationships in your journey? You know, you started out, you're at the family business, you're, you know, trying to earn that name for yourself, get that chip on your shoulder of like, I don't want people to think this is just nepotism. And how then did relationships play into maybe your opportunity at WineSpies, and how have they played a role in your success?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, it's super poignant because it was a friendship that, you know, caused this whole thing to happen in the first place. I mean, we were just one of many vendors selling our wines to WineSpies. And actually at the time, Agent Red was getting engaged. And, you know, as something, we just, it went from a straight up vendor and, you know, customer relationship to, you know, just getting to know each other, being friendly in that conventional way to, you know, oh, you know, I'm getting married soon. Oh, cool. Hey, can I, like, how about I put together an awesome engagement thing? So he actually landed a helicopter at our vineyard and I set up this whole hike through the hillside and, and ended up at a little picnic and stuff, and it was just perfect. You know, which then was a jumping off point for us hanging out more. And what we would end up doing all the time is literally just whiteboarding. And like, you know, he's has all these ideas, and we're, you know, doing the whole, you know, business model generation canvas and like having so much fun with all of that kind of thing. And I think that was what he's like, oh man, like this guy is very good at taking the ideas and helping put this into a process where maybe it's achievable. I want to work with that guy. And he started like a 2-year campaign of trying to recruit me, which I'm like, what are you talking about? Are you crazy, man? Like, this is my family business. I can't ever leave. And, you know, it's just, he caught me at a moment where I was open-minded to it, but it was all based on cultivating that relationship with me in terms of him recruiting talent. And then for me, just in terms of being open to doing fun things, spending an afternoon, not for any particular purpose or making money, but just going and helping a buddy out with his business and his ideas and taking it seriously, you know, and I studiously cultivate relationships within the industry in very specific ways. Like I said, you know, the wine industry is such a small, tight knit community. Like everybody knows each other. So it's really, really important. You know, there's also a lot of big personalities. I mean, I'm part Italian. There's a ton of Italians out here and they like to get into it all the time. And so people make enemies across the board. So I took a very early on a no politics, don't piss people off policy. And I just don't go there. It's like, there's plenty of people that rub me the wrong way. It's just not worth it. You know what I mean? And because of that, it's like, it makes it so much easier to do business with many people, kind of just having that Switzerland policy. And it's way more effective at the long run, and you just leave your options open and you can still be genuine. It's just more about not being petty, you know, and with Wine Spies, the way that we have 365 wines a year is we literally have relationships with, you know, probably 3,000 different vendors, you know, and those are direct with wineries, brokers, distributors, like everybody. And there's a whole crazy Game of Thrones web of alliances with all of that, you know, and it's really, really hard to kind of navigate those waters, but just it's obvious stuff. It's like, do what you say you're going to do. Don't be two-faced, you know, be kind, be easy to work with, be direct. It's just basic stuff, really. But, you know, so much of it, people let the little devil on their shoulder tell them what to do. And just you know, it's way, way, way easier just to like not be governed by like avarice. Like why play it that way? And so it's in a place where relationships are ridiculously important to our business and the lifeblood of it. It's something that I actively work super hard in every interaction just to make sure that I'm making the right choice, you know? And that doesn't mean you don't say no to people. Sometimes you just have to be direct, but people appreciate directness and not bullshitting, you know? So that's one of those good things to do is not bullshit. That's a thing that people will ultimately respect, you know?
That's awesome. Yeah, I think it's a microcosm of the larger world. And it's like, you know, like you said, in wine, it's so critical. It's the backbone of your business. It's the ability to get access to these wines that you're able to sell. It's the ability to transact across all these different relationships and find these opportunities and even find the opportunity you had to join this company and develop into a leading role there. And so all of those come down to this fundamental. I like how you put it. It was like, it's small, simple things, you know, just doing this, just doing this, just doing this consistently. That's how any real skill is. But a lot of people, I think, don't realize how important that is as a form of leverage, just relationship leverage, this ability to be disciplined about my approach to relationships, be disciplined about I can be authentic, but not get into things that are just going to needlessly cause drama or potentially, you know, alienate me.
Sure. Can I give you just an example literally from yesterday?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like so much of what we do is driven by the market. We have to have the best price on the wine literally anywhere in the world. Every day that we sell it, we're the best price in the world for that wine. So a lot of that's governed by the market. It's out there for X amount. We have the profit margin that we know that we need. So, you know, when someone offers us a wine and we're going to go resell it at a discount, you know, we get offers 50 wines. Like we're going to choose 7 of them. The reason we're going to do that is because it fits in our little math. That's just business. This guy yesterday, most people that we work with understand. This guy that we worked with yesterday, you know, he gave us an offer. We countered. It actually, like, it wasn't even that bad. Like, we countered way lower, you know. It wasn't even that bad. And this guy was just like, oh, my God, like, this is outrageous and insulting. And, you know, it's just business, you know. And so the initial reaction that I had was, hey, man, like, it's just business. I'm sorry you're insulted. But frankly, you know, your wine barely was squeaking in the price range of what worked for us anyway. My initial instinct was like, this wasn't even a jerk lowball counter offer. You know, I wanted to tell him, just take a hike, buddy. You know, it's like, just XYZ. And I could have even done it in like a small way that was just like, thank you very much. We appreciate your business. Sorry it didn't work out this time. Later, you know, even that professional tone. But instead, I went out of my way to just be like, here's how we work and why we work the way that we do. So he understood where we were coming from and really taking the time to back up that, you know, we're not, it's just business. Here's why we approach it this way. And then took the time to make him feel comfortable. I didn't care at all about whether or not he felt comfortable. I was super pissed off and wanted to let him know to take a hike, you know, but that's just kind of that thing where it's like, I'm going to take the extra step, even though I'm annoyed by you and I'm in the position of power here. I'm going to take the time to be kind and considerate, even though I don't want to work with you anymore. And then I'm not going to take that guy's wine. But now I put something good out there for next time. And now when that guy is 3 months from now, talk with some other person that are just like, oh, I was thinking about working with Wine Spies. He's not going to be like, oh, blah, blah, blah. Instead, he's going to, you know, say like, oh, you know, like he's going to have that good vibes. And be like, yeah, you know, I didn't get my wine on there, but, you know, they were really fair and nice. And that's cool. You should do that.
Yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, it pays to be really emotionally resilient. And a lot of people don't want to take the time to develop that. And it's, you got to get your ego out of the way if you're going to be able to do that, because you're making, like you said, you're making these deposits into, you can call it karma, but it's pretty logical. It's what your brand's going to be. It's what people are going to say about you behind your back. It's what future opportunities. What if that guy ends up going on to, maybe right now, he's super emotional and he's not a good customer, but maybe 3 years from now, he's at a wine you really want to have on the list. And he's like, you remember, you guys were super respectful. He comes back, you know, it pays because we get in our own ego and we think, oh, I don't need this guy right now. We react. And that has a cascading ripple effect that can damage your business or just slow you down. And so I love that example. It's such a high leverage mindset to think in terms, not in these transactional terms. And it's actually fundamental to what we started on that got us here, which is this idea of relationship leverage. Building it requires a lot of emotional discipline because it's not about you. It's not about you. It's not about your ego. It's about what can you do for the other person. And anytime someone lashes out, they're asking for help. They're saying like, what he was really saying was like, damn, I really wanted this deal, or man, this is not good for me, or I'm frustrated. And so maybe because of his own emotional immaturity, that came out as a insult or a, you know, anger or rude, you know, communication. But if we can hear that and then have empathy for that person and say, hey, yeah, I'm sorry that it came across as disrespectful. Here's our math. Here's why we did it this way. We would have loved to work with you. It just didn't work out for these reasons. And you can leave that good impression. It's this massive advantage that because it compounds and it compounds and it compounds over all those relationships, because people don't know it. They don't know that they're having their own little childhood freak out, but they feel like, oh, that person validated me. And that's so rare in business. So many people be like, hey, it's just business, F off, whatever. And then they'll hate that person forever. They'll hold a grudge. And so it's
very well, they will hold it forever.
Exactly. It's so rare that in business, people lash out and then they experience someone being like a mother figure or a father figure. Like, hey, like, no, I see you're in need. Let me be nice to you. And then they go, oh my gosh, that was different. Like,
well,
that.
And so often, I mean, like, this is my number one piece of advice to people, especially like younger people is, you know, is when people walk into something like wanting something and they're in that defensive mind space, it is so hard for people to be confrontational that when they feel that they need to be, like, they walk in there like ready to do battle, and they are so amped up about, you know, like trying to get whatever they need out of it. And if the first thing that you say to them is, I understand what you need. And especially if you can articulate to them right now, it's like, I know that you need, this money, right? So say the first thing you say to them is, you're going to get your money. You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, like you said, it just diffuses the whole thing, because they're like blindsided. They're like, oh, I thought I was going to have to convince you for the next 30 minutes about this thing I need. But the first thing you say is, you understand what I need? Great. And, it really is, to your point, it's a non-transactional attitude. And in the long run, counterintuitively, I mean, it pays dividends, right? But you're just not looking at it through that lens about like, how am I going to win this next particular thing? We cover the cost of shipping for all of our orders. And that means that our fulfillment costs are, one of our largest cost centers after product. And so that means that our relationship with our 3PL, our fulfillment center, is really important and very expensive, and we have to integrate with them. And there's like a lot of costs there. And there's just so many different areas of friction. And I wrote like an 8-page open letter to them well before I needed something from them, just telling them, I super appreciate you guys. We've worked together for so long. Here's all the different things of the partnership that I actually look at a partnership. Here's all these expenses we've accrued, but I genuinely look at it like an investment in our future together. And then there was no demand. It's like, well, why are you sending this letter if you're going to ask someone to read a 7-page single-spaced letter for nothing, like for no reason? And it wasn't that there's no reason. I want this relationship to be fruitful. And at some point in the future, there may be an ask. I'm not playing a 3D chess game. I'm just letting them know and setting a positive tone without a specific transaction now, so that you know what kind of partner we are. And then when we're sitting down at a table at some point having a negotiation, you're going to be in the mindset where they want to help us, And we recently had a large negotiation, which was had a desirable outcome. You know what I mean? And again, and I think intent matters. I think if you go into it with playing this 3D chess game, people can smell that. It's an authenticity thing. I mean, authenticity, everyone uses that word, but it comes up a lot because it is true, And if you're trying to be manipulative or play those kinds of games, then people just know you to be that particular type of person, and then they'll play the game that same way. But if you just kind of come across instead of just like, you and I are playing an infinite game together, and I'm just going to do my best to help you get what you need genuinely, then the other person will want to do their best to help them do what you need. It really is that simple.
Yeah, there's two really high leverage skills that I want to just point out for the audience. So one is this idea of being able to meet people's emotional needs. Like if they lash out, being able to actually validate them, help them feel okay, safe, really meet their emotional needs instead of pushing back where they expect you to push back. Positioning yourself across from them, etc. So that right there is, again, one of those little basic things that doing that repeatedly builds you. That's massive relationship leverage. The other thing that I noticed in what you said was the idea of making proactive deposits. When you don't need anything, and this is actually a lot of, like you said, young people are like, well, what can I do for someone that doesn't need anything from me? Everyone needs the emotional validation piece. Everyone could use feeling understood or that piece. And so that's one area to start. But making these proactive deposits in the sort of relationship bank, when things are good, if you have the habit of saying, I'm going to highlight that they're good, I'm going to call out they're good, I'm going to share the praise, I'm going to give the compliments, I'm going to have the intention to go make their life better, make the people on the other side, whatever this transaction is, or if there's no transaction, the people on the other side of this relationship, I'm going to go try to make their life better today. I'm going to just share a compliment, thank them for something, point out a way they've been gracious, reinforce the attributes I want them to have in the future. It's kind of like with children. It's the same thing, with your kids. It's like, I'm not going to wait to punish you. I'm going to reward you every time you behave honestly or you do this thing that I want you to do in the future. The more those rewards you deposit up front, then on the back end, when there is a conflict or there is an issue or there is a transaction at play, you don't have to go. It's kind of the same concept. You don't have to close them in that moment. You've done all the work in advance of building the trust, et cetera. And so I think that's an under utilized element of these daily or small habits that on a regular basis, people looking at their relationships and saying, what can I go do for other people? How can I go make those deposits? So two really valuable skills that you highlighted there, that's why I wanted to come back to it. I was sure you had some good stuff because in an industry like mine, relationships matter so much. So you get those reps, you get those skills, and it's exciting to learn some of those from you.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, it kind of is more of just a gardener mentality. You know, you're just kind of like always prepping that ground and you never know what's kind of going to grow out of that, you know. And kind of to riff on, you know, what you're saying for young people out there, you know, it's a lot of times when if you want to get your foot in the door or you want to try to like, you know, get some experience or whatever. And you're like, oh man, I really want to go work in this field. How do I break through? And then, you know, you ask that person, what can I do for you? I'll work for free, whatever. And they're just like, you know, I don't really know. I don't have time for you. To your point, everybody always has something that they need, but it's mostly just they feel like, oh, if I'm going to take the time to show you how to do this thing, it'll have taken as long or longer than for me to just go do the thing. And my whole problem is I don't have enough time. So, you know, I think the thing that is to recognize, you cannot wait for the other person to give you the thing, you know, even if you're coming at it with a super positive attitude, you know, it's like, just look and see what you think the need is. Don't wait for that permission. If you think like, oh, their you know, logo needs a refresh, go try to refresh it yourself and update it, and then send them like 7 different logo designs. Even if they're just like, oh, all these are amateurish and how, like, I don't want to change my logo. It doesn't matter. All of a sudden you just demonstrated, you know, a resource for them. And then you just keep doing that thing until eventually, like, you're going to find the thing that you're like, oh, this is badass. I didn't even know that I wanted this. You know what? And like, I got an intern right now and he just put together this super awesome, like, spy case. So when you open it up, it's like Pulp Fiction. And I'm like, oh, this is so awesome. We could go, you know, do a social media campaign with it. And then it just got crazy without me asking, it got crazier and crazier. Like, now there's like a countdown clock. And then there's like a vape machine is like building up smoke before it opens, so that when it opens, it's like smoke. And now we've got like an invisible ink typewriter. So we're going to, you know, print automated messages in invisible ink and ship it with a Wine Spies flashlight. And, you know, the whole thing turned into this super awesome thing, which for me was really low touch. I mean, he basically did it all. And it all just started with him like, hey, I'm going to go build something, you know, on my own time. And now it's like, oh, I'm super happy to pay you to make this ridiculously awesome campaign, which I know is going to be successful. But had he just asked me like, hey, can I do something cool for social media for you? Tell me what to do, boss. I'd have been like, yeah, I got like 20 other things to do today. Let's schedule a meeting next week. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and I find that one of the, you know, keeping with this theme of relationship leverage, that's one of the easiest ways to transact when you don't have a lot to offer, right? If you can find ways to build relationships, make those deposits, meet people's emotional needs, be supportive, that can open doors because then you can connect people. And so often it's like, you're not going to have the one skill that person you're trying to work with needs, or you're not going to have something to offer them that they may want right now. But if you've put all those deposits into a network of people who might be able to help them, just the right relationship can be invaluable. And making that one connection for them, saying, hey, I know a guy who does that exact thing, let me put you in touch. I mean, for someone only have things to do today, you don't want to go search for and find the guy to do the thing. So you just saved me a lot of effort if that guy can actually show up and deliver. And so just being a connector can be a great source of, when you're early on, being able to then build value for people.
Well, and I just want to add to that. I mean, there's a lot in the process of trying to go figure it out too. It's like now it's like a whole Raspberry Pi board, you know, and he had to go figure out how to do a bunch of different things, including he was pulling some JSON code and like never dealt with like the JSON hooks before. But without even asking for the permission to do the project, he didn't have the skill set at the beginning of the project. It was the attitude of, I'm going to go figure it out in order to deliver this thing. And then regardless of whether or not, you know, as you're putting in a deposit, if you are taking the time to teach yourself and level up while you're doing that, now all of a sudden, not only have you made this deposit and created this goodwill with this person, but you've also, and even if that went nowhere right now, you also just taught yourself things.
Yeah.
And what better way to like like take time to level up your skills than to do that in the service of someone else who might be able to grow your career in the future. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great insight. All right, two more places we're going to go before we wrap up. First is we're going to talk a little bit about AI, and then I want to end on wine because that's obviously your forte. So let's go into AI just a little bit. Just curious, want to know how you're thinking about AI and what ways do you view it as disruptive to your business? Is there anything you're really worried about in your business around AI? Or are there areas where you're really excited and things that you think are going to be really impactful for either you as a tech company or for the wine industry at large?
Yeah, I mean, it's this crazy inflection point, right? Where no one knows exactly where it's going to go. By the way, with your data point earlier, I mean, I actually completely agree with you. I think there's just going to be that AI intermediary layer where it's like, oh, like it just writes the API that you need to take it from this one thing. All of that will go away. It will be seamless. It'll just, whatever it is you need over here to come over here, it'll just write it immediately and you'll be able to, and then all that will be queryable in natural language. So, you know, I totally agree with that vision for the future. And I think you're right about a lot of these considerations are, you know, in terms of like, hey, what particular software platform should I leverage to do this one thing? It'll be actually much easier to do those. So that is actually a big part of what we're thinking about right now. But, you know, everyone's talking about wine reviews. We write like probably about 500 to 1,000 words every single day for each article, for each wine that we sell. So, you know, obviously we've considered how much of that could be ChatGPT. And wait, one thing that we've recognized early on is that what we write is what sells. I mean, it is crazy. Like our guy that does the copywriting, who happens to also be our CMO and is a really good growth hacker type too. He like, I do not know how he comes up with a hook every day, but he does, you know? And it's clear that ChatGPT is still very much at that level of, you know, being able to write well, but not that, you know, really kind of creative, like hits that like engaging hook factor. It sounds pretty GPT-ish. So we'll see where that goes. Who knows, you know, oh, hands are going to take years. Oh, here's perfect hands. You know, maybe that's like really good tomorrow. We'll see. So
just out of curiosity, Nat, have you guys fed in like all his past hooks and prompts? Have you given it like, here's 500 of his past hooks and had it try to mimic him and seen what it comes up with?
Oh yeah. I mean, we've done all that. Right now we've got a pretty solid trained GPT for customer service solutions. And it also does really shockingly good sommelier bots. So you could be like, hey, tell me, you know, about Merlot. And it's just like, boom, based on our content, you know, and it's ridiculous how good it is. And so right now, one of the things that we're doing is we're building what will be called Wine Spies Declassified. And it'll take our whole data set, and then it'll have, every time you access a page, it'll say, you know, like Cabernet Sauvignon, here's an article about it. But you could also have a filter search where it's like Cabernet Sauvignon from, you know, Napa, and then it'll give you a specific article for that. And then there'll be a past sales and current sales listing right next to it, with a sommelier bot that you can engage with chat. So, you know, that's what we're going to leverage. We're building that right now. We've already got sommelier bot. We've done things like, you know, AI workflows where it's taking all of the write-up and then doing a mid-journey background image based on that write-up, and then automatically spitting that out and putting it into our Amazon web server, just like using that image for the background. And all that stuff works great. You can plug it in all together with Zaps and things like that these days, and it works out fine. What'll be the interesting point is where all this stuff kind of comes together in a user experience. So one of the things we've been thinking really carefully right now, and I've got an excellent web designer trying to make this really work, is, you know, as I just described, you could have like Chardonnay from Santa Lucia Highlands, and then it'll spit out that article. But then you've also got the little button to chat, and you've got your GPT right there. Why do I have all this static content here that could be you over here? This guy's talking to you. You know, when it comes to actual design and interface, you know, how does this all actually result in the most pleasant consumer experience? And then how do I get SEO juice out of that? And, you know, and how do I then have this work with a sales funnel where I'm like, hey, how about these wines? You know, and there's just so much possibility there that it's almost an embarrassment of riches. And we're being really studious right now about trying to figure out like implementations that feel fresh and feel interesting, but are also like that are usable in a way that's not just like a GPT, like blank canvas, you know? And that's going to be the secret sauce right now is if you just give someone a prompt, blank box, okay, ask about anything. People don't go to Wikipedia, to the homepage, or, you know, and just like, what do you want to search about? Like, that's not really how you do it, you know? So giving people some way to take them through it in a creative, interactive way is, I think, what we're trying to pioneer right now. It's a super fun time, man. Like, yeah, excited.
Yeah, it's very much like the interface that I like as a metaphor is, it's sort of like you're introducing an expert consultant or sales rep in a store. So if I was in a physical store and I was looking at a bottle and I was reading the label and I was having that experience, what experience with a rep coming up to me would be really annoying and just, oh God, this, oh, hey, can I help you find anything else? Is there something else you can buy? And I was just like, dude, this isn't a great experience versus like, hey, I noticed that particular bottle and you were watching this before. Here's something you might take, you know, like, let me give some additional story or some additional, like, what is that? Let me bring some value that you're going to want that I've been watching you. And, you know, if it's okay, I'd be happy to teach you a little bit more about this or, you know, bring some additional insights where then you're like, oh, this is really nice. Like this person's really helping me get what I want. We've all had those experiences that are really trashy, just like, oh man, sales rep coming down our throat versus like, man, that was a great experience. That person really added value. And I think the world of AI is going to go through that same type of a thing. And so it's really cool to see how you guys are exploring that interface to try to make it that enriching experience that's going to add value, that's going to feel nice. It's going to, because it's just like any automation, you know, it can be too much really quick or distract, you know, words.
The challenge of like, you know, bringing, I like the Wikipedia experience where you're reading an article. It's how we all do it. We're like reading about this thing. We're like, oh, cool, I want to learn more about that. Click the hyperlink. Next article, and then you just keep on doing that. But that's a way that you actually explore and engage, and everyone loves to do that. You know, so taking that AI generated content based on our data sets, but then creating a static like Wikipedia like article based on that. But then to what extent is that customized when I want to learn about Julian Fayard and Sonoma Valley? And then are we getting SEO juice out of that being like printed and then cached, you know? And then is there going to be any sort of copyright issues with that? Or do we have to have some sort of, you know, workflow where we're reviewing it so there's not anything scandalous or any IP issues? And, you know, all of these different considerations that are kind of coming out of it, because the easiest thing to do in the world right now is just take a data set, trade a chatbot on it, and then plop it on your site that we have done, you know, but then taking that next step in terms of creating a useful resource for people, you know, I think we're gonna get it right. One thing that I wanted to point out for your audience is just being aware of your limitations. You know, I actually can do pretty good graphic design to the point where I would consider myself quite professional. Just something that I've taught myself over the years, not because I've ever had to do that for a career. I've done hundreds of wine labels and I've got an eye for it. And I'm a pretty good product manager, and then I work with our CTO and dev team to do all this stuff. But when we did Lockers V1, I tried to do it myself, and like literally, like I'm like, here's what I want it to look like. Did all the mockups, you know, like if Figma existed, then I would have done it in Figma. I'm like, here's what I want, and you know what? It was functional, and it wasn't necessarily ugly, but it wasn't the best it could be. And when we redesigned it from scratch, and we worked with a super talented designer, his UX was so much better than mine, you know? And it's not doubting yourself, and it's not stopping to build your core competencies, but especially when you have to deliver like a really important high level product, like just recognize that you might not be able to do it better than somebody else. In fact, you probably can't. So you should probably go figure out at that point, leverage talent when you need to.
Yeah.
You know, and being aware of when to do that.
I think someone phrased it to me as, in a coaching context, what's the likelihood you're the best in the world at this?
Yeah.
And so if you're not, then why not take the time, if you have the capital to deploy, to find someone who's closer to being that person? And it's not you, so you're also not spending your time on it. And so sometimes it's a helpful way to break out, because often when we look at the choices that we readily can see, which is me, some of my staff, maybe the consultants I know, it's like, yeah, I'm the best option among us. Like, well, you might be, but have you taken the time to find the right options? Because if you go put in a little effort to finding some additional options, very quickly you won't be the best option. And now you can operate at a higher level. So that is a very high leverage skill that you're pointing out there. All right, I want to end real quick on wines. So I personally don't drink much. Occasionally I do. And when I drink, I enjoy wine as one of my favorite kind of experiences. I think a lot of people feel intimidated. Wine sometimes feels a little bit like I think a lot of people look at wine as like, I buy some cheap stuff, I know nothing about it, and whatever, I know I'm not in the culture, or I need to be all the way in the culture. I need to make sure my temperatures are right and I'm letting it breathe, and then I'm, you know, decanting it. I'm doing all these things. I need to learn all the little intricacies and I'm properly smelling it and then savoring it. And like, have I learned the whole experience, right? And so I've been to places where they kind of coach you through some of those things. And I'm like, oh, this is a whole different experience. What advice would you have for people that maybe are on that, like, I just buy a cheap bottle of wine and if it tastes good, cool. What advice would you have for people that maybe want to learn more about wine culture, but it might feel a little hard, like inapproachable? How can they get more involved, or how can they develop those skills? What have you seen?
Yeah, for sure. Well, so two things. One is, if you like buy wine and you like it, then that is all you need to know. Like, seriously. And anybody else that tells you otherwise, like, you don't know what you're talking about, they could go straight to hell. Like, the main problem with the word you didn't use, but I know you're trying to like dance around, is that stuffiness, right? And it's just like, you know, that is so off-putting to people. And I am like absolutely fight against that. Even when you're walking with a super baller tasting room in the middle of the wine cave, I'm like, meet you where you're at, you know? And that whole pretentiousness thing is just the so not what is actually wine itself is about. And it used to be the case where there was a lot, like, there really weren't that many options in terms of wine brands. There's all like that. Now there is so many different levels of, you know, like fun wine labels, interesting wine labels, all kinds of stuff. You know, you go to Trader Joe's, man, like there's like a selection across the board. So there's a wine out there for you no matter where you're at. And anyone that's coming at you with an attitude, tell them to take a hike. So that's number one. But what's cool about it is that wine is genuinely interesting. And so when you get past that off, you know, when you want to start going on that journey and learning more, there's always a place that you can get met along the way, rather than being all freaked out by like, oh, I got to know all these things and the temperatures. And when I get handed the wine list at some super nice restaurant, I don't know what any of these things are or mean, and I'm scared about picking up. People get like kind of anxious about all that. And then they're like, oh, I don't want to play, I'll just go open a beer. You know what I mean? The number one thing that I could recommend, which is super easy to do and anybody can do it, it's as simple as this. When you try a wine, just literally look at the label, like hopefully like as you're sipping it, and just try to remember what it is you're drinking. Like, what varietal is this? Where does it say it's from? And just pretty much that. And then if you could try to remember the vintage too, but you don't even need to do that. I know people, like really rich people that spend a lot of money on wine and they don't know shit about wine. They like it and they drink it a lot, but they kind of are still stuck at that level of like, I don't really know anything about it. And it's because they just like, they never connect the dots between what I'm drinking right now, what's in my mouth, and what this bottle says is in it. And then what you'll find is as you pay attention to what you drink, as long as you're just making that simple, quick connection, then you'll be like, oh, like I remember now that I like Pinots from Santa Rita Highlands, you know, and you'll just start to know more what you like. And then next time you go to like a restaurant and you're like, oh, I remember I like Santa Rosa Pita Highlands, and then I'm going to try that. And then where people a lot of times get stuck is they'll just know the one thing that they like that they know and then keep going back there. So the next secret sauce is just try new things and then try to remember what it is you tried. And then is don't let any snob tell you if you don't like it, you're wrong. If you don't like it, you don't like it, and that's okay. and then try the next thing. And then, oh, I like this. And then over time, you just naturally, you get more into it. You know more what you like. You know more different things. And then if you want to, you know, go on Wikipedia and read an article about it, cool. There's a bunch of interesting beginner books out there. But all that stuff comes naturally after just making that simple connection between, hey, I like this, I don't like it, and remembering which one you did not like.
I mean, that's awesome. That's great advice. And in fact, I'm inspired. So I think what I'm going to do is from now on, I'm going to write notes. I'm going to take a little journal, Apple Notes. I'm going to have a little wine journal that says, I tried this, because it's true that actually some of the best ones I've ever had, I'm like, yeah, I remember that. I'll remember like it was, you know, a Sauvignon Blanc, or it was a Pinot Grigio, or it was a like, I'll remember that part, but I don't remember where it was from, what varietal there, like even the brand or anything. I'm just like, oh, I can't remember. You know, I know that on a wine tasting in Italy that I was at, we had this crazy good thing, and I have a bottle of it upstairs.
And that's the thing, is people, that's where people get stuck, because they went on that trip and they're like, oh yeah, I had the best time. Oh man, I went to the one place, what was it, like Deerwood, Deer Park? And like, yeah, it was bomb. I loved it. And then that, you see how it just ends there.
Yeah. Right.
Apple Notes, just have that thing, and then just literally write down the wine name. That's it.
All right, I'm going to do it. That way I can start to appreciate more. All right, if people are interested in getting you more, learning more about Agent Crew, or even more importantly, if they want to try some more wines, take your advice, and want to do it in a really affordable way with Wine Spies, where would you send people and where can they find you?
Winespies.com, baby. Let's throw up a one-time use coupon code for Leverage. So Leverage, that'll be the code word. Throw it on there. Check us out. Always legit. Always amazing wines. Always good prices. Yeah. Please come try it out and pop a bottle with us. And thanks so much for having me on, man. This has been a genuine pleasure. Super fun. Obviously, I love where your head's at. I can tell that we could go enjoy a glass of wine, have a good time.
Let's do it. I come out to California often, so we'll make it happen.
All right. Sounds like a plan, man.
Alrighty.
Hey, before you go, I have a small request. Our mission is to empower as many people as possible to maximize their potential through the power of leverage. Could you help us in this mission by leaving a review on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube? And if you know just one person who would benefit from today's episode, would you please share it with them? Your support means the world to us, and we are thrilled to have you in the community. Thank you for being a part of our journey and helping us grow. You can find show notes for today's show and past shows at lessonsinleverage.com, which also has links to connect with me personally and connect with our various podcast channels across your favorite social networks. A big thanks to Solve.cloud, who sponsored this episode. They're a group of expert consultants that help SaaS and financial services companies to implement, optimize, and manage Salesforce.com. They can help you with custom integration solutions and are helping customers to implement some of the most important generative AI technologies. You can find them at Solve.cloud. That's SOLVD.cloud is the URL. Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.